From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connector for this hour is made in the pages of Forbes magazine, which just released their 2015 30 Under 30 in the Field of Science. And one of the 30 Under 30 is Ellika Bergelson. She is a newly appointed research assistant professor at the University of Rochester. Here's why Forbes explained that they decided to spotlight Ellika. Quote, Bergelson, the child of Russian immigrants, became fascinated by how it is that we learn language. Now she studies language acquisition in infants. Neat findings. Around 6 months, infants start understanding words for foods and body parts. Not until 10 months do they get words like uh-oh or verbs like eat. Well, that's just the start of why Forbes chose to profile her, and this hour we're talking about the next generation of scientists. We sit down with two of them. Ellika is here, along with David Paul, who's pursuing a career in neurosurgery at the University of Rochester. His research focuses on developing biomarkers that predict recovery after brain injury. Ellika Bergelson and David Paul, welcome to Connections. David, how are you? Good. Thanks for being here. Ellika, thank you for being here.
No problem. Thanks for having us.
And before we jump into the next generation of scientists, we are wrapping up. I think we're getting close to wrapping up a pledge drive. I keep hearing something in my... I think I'm hearing our volunteers in the next room over there, Randy. And you know what? We want the phones to ring. Randy Gorman is our news director, and he's here.
They are getting excited, Evan, because I think at last count, we were at about $133,000 with about $17,000 left to go for our goal, which is excellent. We may be able to wrap this up today, but we need your support to do that. And don't forget, of course, as you're listening to us, we expanded the show not only with Evan being on board now for about a year or so, but also on WEOS and WRUR. And if you're a listener to the show on those stations to Connections, please consider pledging right now. The number is 1-800-295-9994. That's 1-800-295-9994. Or it's just as easy to securely go on our website, WXXI.org. Great programming, as Scott and I were talking about, Scott Feibusch, a few minutes ago. Evan, of course, to do these shows, there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes, preparation, research, and of course, you know, all of the various things that go on with just keeping the station on the air, not to mention what we do for you in news every day. We've got a lot of great news series we're working on right now, including one we're looking at childcare in the area, some other subjects to come up we'll tell you about in the weeks to come. But all that takes resources, so we need your help. Please just help us get to that goal, because it's a very important part of the programming that you come to expect from us every day.
Can I mention what we've got coming up over
sure.
the next like few days? Because I'm not even sure you know.
I hope I do. Otherwise, I'm in trouble.
You've been. Next hour, we've got Fairport Superintendent Bill Calla live on the program. He has been sharply critical of the governor's education agenda. We're going to find out why. Tomorrow, we're talking about transparency in government with not only a local attorney who focuses on that, but also good government groups in Albany. They're wondering, why is the next speaker being chosen essentially behind closed doors, especially with the issue Sheldon Silver has? So we're focusing on that tomorrow. We're also going to talk about 1 year after Ukraine, and Rock Euromaidan is a group that's going to be in studio tomorrow telling us, hey, let's not forget about what happened a year ago when we were talking about issues in Ukraine. We're going to get an update there. Later this week, we're going to talk about the differences and similarities between Islam and Christianity, a local author of books comparing them. And we're going to hear from Jack Garner with an Oscar preview. And then next week, we're talking about why Budweiser really screwed up their ad in the Super Bowl. They poked the craft beer bear.
I saw your tweets
last night.
That might
not have been wise.
And that was interesting because they sort of, we'll do a whole show on microbreweries.
we're going to hear from what the craft beer movement says about why Budweiser went after them last night. It was fascinating to watch. And so look at the diversity of subjects we've got coming up.
And just a good example of, again, the kind of programming that you only get, I think, these days in public broadcasting. So please think about us right now. The phone number again, 1-800-295-9994, or just make a pledge at WXXI.org at our secure website. We want to make that goal today, and thanks for contributing.
Thank you, Randy. And last thing I'll say on that to our listeners, if you've become sort of a connections addict in the last year, or you're one of the folks who tells me you listen at work, or you find a way to be in your car from noon to two, and you get stuck in your parking lot or your driveway, which is always our goal, and you've never called before, we'd love to have you. This is a community of people, and we need you. That's it. We'll see Randy later in the hour. Let's turn our attention to our monthly science roundtable. And again, Ellika Bergelson and David Paul are here. Ellika, when did you find out that Forbes had chosen you for 30 Under 30?
Well, I found out they were considering me back in, I want to say, in the fall sometime. I got an email saying that I had been nominated and could I answer these very serious questions. And then maybe about a month later, I got an email with some less serious questions that were a little goofier.
Was that sort of a tip-off?
I thought maybe they'd narrowed the list a little since they were asking about my favorite gadgets and bedtime.
And then, wow.
And then
this is truly the next generation of science.
That's right. And then I think the official news came out early this on the 5th or so.
Great honor for you. If you look at the 30 under 30, a great, as you would assume, sort of diversity of fields of study, from technology and biofuel and everything else. And we're going to be talking about what Elica has really focused on. It's a good thing you got this done now, because you're going to be 30 soon. You're not going to be under 30 for much longer.
I barely squeezed in. Yeah.
David Paul's got a little bit longer. You're a little younger than Elica, 26 years old, and your field of study is neuroscience. First of all, it's got to be neat to see a colleague across the table recognized this way by Forbes.
Oh, most definitely.
Yeah, and for you, David, again, at 26 years old, where do you want to be? Where do you want to be in 5, 10, 20 years?
Well, the road on the path to neurosurgery is a long one. And so 5 to 10 years, I see myself in residency and then, you know, graduating from residency and being a practicing neurosurgeon in an academic setting somewhere.
It does take a while. And I have a stepbrother who is a surgeon now, and it took him years, more, well over a decade. You've really got to be right with your choice. I mean, you don't want to get 7 years in and think, I don't know if I want to do this. You've got to have a pretty good sense for it, don't you?
Yeah, most definitely.
What attracts you to neuroscience?
Well, I've been attracted to neuroscience for a pretty long time, actually since I was young. My parents in the third grade had me sit down and read a book by a neurosurgeon named Ben Carson, who grew up in Detroit. And, you know, he had stories in there just about doing surgeries on the brain, separating twins that were conjoined at the head. And I thought it was the most amazing thing. And ever since then, I was hooked.
Are you surprised that Ben Carson might be your next president?
I am not surprised. He's a pretty smart guy. But, you know, we're here to talk about science.
Yeah, that's a smart answer, yeah. David. Good for you. That's a great answer. You're getting thumbs up from everybody around the table. I'm putting David on the hot seat there. Now, Ben Carson could run for president. He might not. But, again, David is talking specifically not from a political perspective, but just from a science professor perspective. Elica Bergelson, at 29 years old, you focus on language, I mean, among other things. I don't want to diminish it, but the work that you've been doing, for me, is really fascinating. I've got a child who's going to turn 3 next month, and watching language development has been so interesting to me. So I want to start by kind of, on your side, walking through how you've gone about researching this, and then we'll talk about some of the implications and the applications. But where did this interest come from?
Sure. So I guess similar to what David is saying, it started when I was a kid. So my parents are from Russia, and then they lived in Israel for a decade. And so there are a lot of languages bouncing around my house growing up. I have 3 older siblings and a younger sibling. So there's always a mixture of languages and people learning or speaking in their native language or their not native language. So I think that's where I first got interested in that kind of thing. And then when I got to college, I realized this is a thing people study. And really, the best language learners are babies. And so that's, I think, what took me down that path. You know, you or I could spend the next couple years studying Mandarin Chinese and make much less progress than your daughter has made with English in the last couple years.
Son, but yes.
Son, sorry.
That's okay. It's a great point. And I want to talk about language development. And I also want to ask you, how many languages do you speak?
Well, we grew up, we had to speak Russian at home. It was okay. The rules.
No, was that first language?
My English is more native than my Russian, but yeah, I guess both of them at the same time. So Russian and English, and then I studied French in school and some Hebrew also.
Okay. You could handle all 4?
I could handle
in
3
conversation?
Plus. 3.5 of them.
3.5 of them.
Yeah.
And why is it that, I guess there are probably obvious reasons, but why is it that infants, that the older we get, the harder it is to learn language?
Well, that's, I think, the mystery, right? So in most cases, fully competent adults are really good at learning new things. But babies who can't walk yet, can't talk yet, can't follow social cues very well, seem to have the plasticity in their brains and a lot of underlying mechanisms that lead them to actually be better learners. And that's, I think, part of what makes it an interesting question from a cognitive science perspective.
My son at 12 months, one of his first words was coffee. And, you know, my wife and I joked that that was mildly embarrassing, but that's probably revelatory of what he sees all around him. And he couldn't say F, so he would say cocky for a while until it was actually a sad day for us when he put the F on it, because it was kind of cute for a while, you know.
Right.
But you have looked at, your research has helped see when that recognition of words is happening. And for a long time, the assumption is 9 months, 10 months, a year, you start associating words. Walk me through your kind of research and what we've learned.
Sure. So what we do is look at babies' eye movements as a cue to what they understand about the world around them. So all of us have a receptive vocabulary and a productive vocabulary, and you certainly know a lot more words than you say on a regular basis. And this is true for babies also. So they start understanding words much earlier than they start saying them. We've always known that. But we weren't quite sure when that started. There was some work in the literature, you know, Charles Darwin wrote down that his child understood the word for nanny when they were quite small. But we hadn't really tested a lot of young babies using these eye tracking techniques until fairly recently with some of our work and others around the world too. And so what we do is we show infants come in, they sit in their parents' lap and they see a couple pictures on the screen or a couple video clips, and then mom or another voice names part of the images on the screen and we see where they look.
For example, the images?
For example, a picture of a mouth and a picture of an apple. And then mom says, look at the apple. And mom can't see the screen, so she can't bias the kid. But we then see where do they look. And so we track their eye movements. And so the technology these days, it's pretty advanced. And so all it takes is just this infrared camera at the bottom of the screen that tracks where they're looking. And then we use that as a proxy of what they know. So if I say, look at the water bottle, you sort of have to do it. You as an adult can control yourself and can keep from doing that. But in general, that's the way that we look at the world around us, is we are directed by the linguistic signal we're getting.
What kind of a sample size?
It varies from study to study. The big project we're starting now, we're hoping to have 48 babies completed. It's a big year-long thing, but typically between 20 and 40 for a given study.
And forgive me, statistically significant, I guess? I'm assuming.
That's right. The way we usually talk about these effects is that they are modest but consistent across babies and across the different items that we test.
Okay, and you're finding at 6 months that recognition. Have you looked at 4 months? Have you looked at 8 months?
We haven't. People say, you know, have you tested in utero? No. Obviously, there's going to be some limit on it. We started at 6 months thinking that that'll be the age where they don't do anything. And then it turned out that they did. So we haven't pushed younger than that. But that's an open question.
All right. So interesting. So you started at 6 months thinking you were going to get one result and you got another.
Right.
Very interesting. And probably exciting, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the joy of science is... You know, occasionally you disprove. I mean, you're not just out to prove something. Sometimes you disprove something. So what does that mean to you? Help me draw some conclusions now.
Yeah. So
that's all the media really cares about is packaging things in a really cogent little sound bites, right, and overgeneralizing if we can.
Yeah. Well, so I guess the, you know, sort of big memo to parents would be talk to your kids and, you know, they're real social partners, even though at 6 months they're just, you know, getting out of their looks like a chicken crust with an old man stage of life. but they are real social partners already. They're learning. They're definitely listening to what you're saying.
Not every child looks like a chicken crust with an old man, but many of them do. I actually... Well, look, Elka's going to take me down a very inappropriate road here. But I told our friends before my son was born, you do not have to tell me I've got a beautiful child whenever the child's born. Because a lot of babies are not necessarily... I got to be careful. but I remember the Seinfeld episode with Kramer. And do you remember that episode?
I don't.
Okay, see. David, anybody? Am I alone on this? And the ugly baby? Okay, anyway. I'm going to stop there. My wife is at home going, oh my gosh, please stop. I do think all babies are beautiful. Let me put it that way. Now... I read an article in the New York Times, and I would assume you've seen it, and I bet you this was out maybe 6 months ago, The Power of Talking to Your Baby. What scares me is thinking about the difference between, and the New York Times focused on this, the gap between children in impoverished homes and children not in impoverished homes, because they're hearing a lot more words. And we're not even talking about a breadth of vocabulary. We're talking about just consistency of hearing actual words spoken. And I want to quote from this. Tina Rosenberg writes in the New York Times on this, again, the power of talking to your baby. Quote, the gap between poor children and wealthier ones widens each year, and by high school, it has become a chasm. American attempts to close this gap in schools have largely failed, and a consensus in starting to build that these attempts must start, hold on a second, it's starting to build that these attempts must start long before school, before preschool, perhaps even before birth. There's no consensus, however, about what form these attempts should take, because there's no consensus about what the problem truly is. What is it about poverty that limits a child's ability to learn? Researchers have answered the question in different ways. Is it exposure to lead? Character issues like a lack of self-control or failure to think of future consequences, the effects of high levels of stress hormones, the lack of a culture of reading. Well, how about this idea, however? A poor child is likely to hear millions fewer words at home than a child from a professional family. and the disparity matters. You've seen this kind of story?
I have, yeah. And so I am aware of that research, and we've done some of that too. So in graduate school in Philadelphia, we had a wider range of socioeconomic statuses coming into the lab, and we found that with 19-month-olds, for every level of mother's education increasing, you find a 5% increase in the baby's performance at 19 months to look at words that are common words that they hear all the time. So we find these kinds of effects pretty early on across the board. I think that the quotes you just selected do highlight the fact that it's a complicated issue.
Sure.
And, you know, if you have a single parent home with multiple jobs and you get home at the end of the day, are you going to take the next 3 hours to read that dozen children's books you have in the corner? Maybe not. And I think that we are starting to try to tackle some of that. But exactly the point you made is that before preschool, some of these things are already in place. And so the more we actually understand about the mechanisms that underlie language learning, the better position we'll be in to actually help.
In other words, the ideal way to study this would be to have the only variable be the spoken words. You know,
right.
Essentially, it's the same family. And unfortunately, You can't set up an experiment that works this way. You could not possibly convince a family, because ideally, I think it would be children in the same household, but you wouldn't tell parents, hey, for this child, we want you to talk a lot around them and help develop their language, and then the next child, we want you to not talk. No one would agree to that. It would be sort of unethical. Does that make it more challenging on the scientific study perspective?
Absolutely. So that there's these differences in the in children themselves are different one to the other, but their environments are also different. And we're starting to tackle this in some sense with the project I'm doing now, where we're measuring babies' at-home environments. And so we get these day-long recordings of what all the linguistic input babies are getting in a given day. And then my research assistants and I, we listen and we count up things like how many object words the baby's hearing. And I think that that does the ethics involved. You're not going to have separate twins raised, one in this place and one in that place, to work some of these issues out. But the technology is starting to be there so that we can ask some of those questions better.
Is there a scientific feeling about baby talk? And I'm serious about that. I mean, I remember my wife and I had conversations and we said, you know, we're not really baby talk people anyway, but we're just going to talk to our son. And when it clicks in, it'll click in, but we're going to talk to him sort of normally.
Yeah, there is a lot of debate about this. So it's called motherese or infantese, or, you know, it's that, oh my gosh, look at the apple kind of talk.
Goo, 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 gaga,
that's
yeah,
right. So I think there's no reason to use made-up words.
Okay.
But there is some evidence that the exaggerated intonation contours, so the big, like, woo kinds of sounds, help bring the child's attention to what you're doing and might help them. So they're still figuring out how many vowels are in this language. What are even the sounds in my language, right? Because babies could be dropped anywhere, and in Japan it'll be these sounds, and in America it'll be these sounds. So to help them figure some of that stuff out, one of the theories on the table is that this exaggerated motherese helps with that. But I'm with you. I don't think we need to do much goo-goo-gaga at the babies.
We're talking to Elika Bergelson, whose work on language development has earned her attention here in Rochester, at the University of Rochester, of course, and in Forbes magazine. She's one of 30 under 30 in the field of science this year. It's a nice honor as we talk about the next generation of scientists this hour. It's our monthly science roundtable. I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to hear your approach to language as a parent, what you saw in your own children. And I don't say that because everything is either right or wrong. I mean, I think to some degree we get into these parent wars where you did it this way or you did it that way. I'm not really interested in that. I'd love to hear listener perspective on what they observed. Not to criticize others, but what might have worked for you with your kids. I'm always fascinated. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Now, a friend of ours, who happens to be University of Rochester professor, but not in your department, Elika, has a daughter who plays with my son, and she is a young polyglot herself. She speaks Spanish and English. And my son is always jealous of that. I mean, like he hears her at almost 3 years old speaking a lot of English and then a lot of Spanish. And he'll come home and he'll want to try some Spanish words. So I can speak conversationally enough to try. What I don't know, but I suspect, is that children who grow up as polyglots, there must be benefits outside of even language, but I don't know. Is there research there?
Yeah, and this is a big debate in the field, so it's about the cognitive advantage that it might confer to you. I think the basic idea glossing over lots of details, is that if you form the idea of what something abstract is sooner, that can only be helpful. So, you know, you're learning one language, you have the word pencil for this thing right here. But if you're learning multiple languages, then a pencil is a thing in the world, and you have this label you can apply to it, and you have this other label you could apply to it. So it sort of might help you in your general cognitive development. There's also some ideas that it helps you shift attention, because you have to suppress the part of your brain that is trying to say the word in the other language all the time, so that you're producing things in the language you're intending to. So yeah, it does seem to confer advantages outside of the language domain.
Have you thought about your own experience in that?
Do I think that it's helpful that I speak more than... Sure, it's especially helpful when you try to travel somewhere and talk to the people there.
I think, for me, my assumption is just that it is going to help understand different cultures, different people, that the world isn't just the small house that you live in. And I hope that I remind myself to try to push my son a little bit more. But I've got to brush up on my own Spanish. Is it helpful for parents to relearn languages?
It's never bad. I mean, I think, is it good? Is it bad? I think that definitely the evidence comes down on the side of it's not bad for your kid to have multiple languages. There was that concern for a while. Whether it's going to turn your child into the next Einstein, no, probably not. But I think from my personal perspective, it's never a bad idea to have more languages, both in the adult case and in the kid's case.
What do you study next? Well, especially with the success and the attention you're getting for what you're doing now, what are your ideal sort of modes of study going forward, and what do you hope to do?
So the piece we're bringing in now is adding, so what my typical bread and butter study is, babies come into the lab, they know what they know, and we test that. And now we're adding the pieces, which is, what is their home life like? So what are they seeing from their perspective? What are they hearing from their perspective? And combine that kind of information over time. So right now we have babies that we're bringing in. We're going to their house once a month from 6 months to 18 months and putting little cameras on their heads and recording the world from their perspective. And adding that information in when we bring them back into the lab. So we test them on some everyday words like mouth and apple, but some words that might be that toy that you have at your house.
Is David getting called out? Do you have to leave?
No, I'm good.
I just want to make sure you're all right. If you've got to go, I can get you on the phone. But I was just get over to David. All right, I just want to make sure everything's okay. Go ahead, Alec.
So the new part of the new direction we're moving in is actually taking concrete measures of children's home environment and then looking at the linguistic and visual and social kinds of things that happen on an individual kid basis and connecting that to what they demonstrate knowledge of in the lab.
Pretty important to be able to do that in a way that's unobtrusive, I guess.
Correct. And it's not every parent that says, sure, come on over once a month and put this camera on my kid's head. But we have a great group of parents so far, and we're still recruiting at the Rochester Baby Lab. So it does take a certain kind of parent. And we're doing some controls to make sure that we're not getting a particularly strange sample by doing this, an overly enthusiastic sample. But our parents are great.
And if I'm going to distill it again, in a simple fashion, what we've already learned from your work and what we're learning is that maybe we shouldn't underestimate what infants can understand, huh? That it really is pretty remarkable. The more they're hearing, the more they may be processing, even if they can't express it yet.
That's right. Talk to them, read them books, treat them like real people.
We're going to take a 60-second break, and then we're going to hear about David Paul's research side of things and what's exciting to him. We recently on this program talked about brain injury, and I want to hear about his take on his field, specifically what he's studying, and where we go next in the field of sort of biomarkers when it comes to brain injury, healing, etc. So much to talk about as we talk to the next generation of scientists this hour. It's our monthly science roundtable. 60 seconds, and we're right back with you on member-supported public radio. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and our news director, Randy Gorbman, has popped in here for just a moment to let us know that we are hopefully nearing the end of our pledge drive, but we have to get there, and then before it's over, we've got to get to 150.
Right. We still have about 15,000 or a bit more than that to collect, but we really want to try and do that today so we can bring in more of the great programming. This is a fascinating topic today. Young scientists from the U of R, and as you know, we do a lot of interviews with folks at the University of Rochester, as well as RIT and all the fine institutions around our area.
No question.
But I mean, you know, academia in this area for a city the size provides a great resource for us. But again, in order to kind of mine all of this data, all of these great people that you're talking to today, it takes resources, it takes people. And we really could use your help right now if you're listening to us, either right here on WXXI or Connections also heard on WEOS out in Geneva and WRUR here in Rochester. You can call us at 1-800-295-9994. That's 1-800-295-9994. Or you can make a donation right online. Very easy, a secure website, WXXI.org. And again, the sooner that we reach that goal today, this could mean that tomorrow morning, Beth Adams will bring you the full slate of news, as will NPR. We won't have to have any interruptions if we can make that goal today. We don't have that much more room to go.
All right, Randy, thank you very much. I'm Evan Dawson, and we're talking about the future of science with a couple of people who are doing some fascinating things in research. I should also ask Elika Bergelson before I turn it over to David Paul on what he's doing. When it comes to language, you did mention something that kind of stood out to me. You said infants can understand words before they can say them. And I feel like in adulthood, it's the opposite. If I try to dust off Spanish, I'm constantly saying to friends, más despacio, por favor, please slow down. You speak so fast, I can't understand. And I feel like I can only say what I can understand. It's sort of a strange, it kind of turns it on its head. I mean, I don't know if this makes sense to you, but for me, it shows the difference in trying to learn at an older age versus learning it from infancy.
That's right. Well, I think that part of it has to do with the way that you learn it. So when you're in a classroom learning Spanish, the sort of style of learning is different. And we don't have very many studies where we just take a grown-up, fully-fledged grown-up, and drop them in another country for a few years and see how they learn with no kind of support and no kind of help. But I think that, yeah, there are differences between the second language learning case later in life and the way babies do it. Babies do it better.
Would you, if you had your way with American education, and stick around next hour, that's where we're really going. Would you like to see more language taught at an earlier age in this country?
Absolutely. I think it's a little crazy that we wait until middle school usually to start the second language education at school. At least when I was growing up in Ohio, that's how it was, where all the data shows the earlier you start, the more chance you have of successfully becoming fluent in another language.
So you get a sense for what Elika Bergelson has been working on. David Paul is an MD candidate at the University of Rochester. Graduated with your master's last year, is that right?
That's correct.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And your research focuses on developing biomarkers that predict recovery after brain injury, particularly with people who've had brain tumors, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
All right, so take me through some of that.
Okay. So the patients that we study have tumors in their brain that compress the sort of nerves that are responsible for carrying information about vision to your brain. So these tumors are located right underneath what we would call like the optic nerve. And they get really big. They compress these nerves and they cause vision loss, a particular sort of type of blindness in these patients. And typically, we've seen these patients in, you know, the neurosurgery clinic, and we operate on these patients to take these tumors out. And we notice that many of these patients, they actually recover their vision after surgery, which is something that's really unique because when you think about a lot of brain injuries, a lot of injuries are permanent.
Right.
You get an injury, you have some sort of stroke, there's permanent injury to the brain. And here we have an awesome model of individuals who have this type of injury to this nerve, who lose their vision and get it back. And we want to know, what is unique about these patients that you could have so much damage to nerves in the brain, and their brain is able to compensate for that and get that vision back? And so that's what we're looking at in our particular study.
Do we have an answer yet?
Yes. So we actually just published a report. It's our first paper that we published on these patients. And we see sort of awesome regeneration process in the brain where when we take these tumors out of these individuals' brains, the insulation around those nerves So think of a nerve as like a cable wire, okay? Like the cable wire that you put in your television. And the insulation is sort of the rubber material on the outside of that wire. And the sort of, you know, nerve itself is like the copper part coming out. And with the tumors, they sort of degrade away at that rubber, which makes them, you know, not work very properly. And we see that with our study after surgery, that rubber material comes back. And it comes back really quickly, within about 2 to 4 weeks. And there's a, you know, a strong correlation between sort of the insulation coming back and people being able to see again.
So when I've always heard about brain injuries, whether it's a stroke or whether it's an accident, you know, I guess a trauma, that as you mentioned, David, that there's this idea that if part of the brain is injured, it's permanent. Or I was always told, well, that part of the brain died, that the brain has to compensate. Which is why occasionally people with brain injury, speech doesn't always come back to the same way as before. Is there an application that could be broader with what you're studying? Are we changing the way we not only understand brain injury, but can deal with it?
Yes, we are. I think, though, we have to take a step back and realize that there's different types of brain injury. And the brain injury we are studying is specific to sort of these nerves. And stroke and traumatic brain injury, although, it's the brain, it's a different type of injury, and there's different sort of mechanisms and processes that are in play. I think what's important for us is we're sort of developing a technique in which we can look at patients from a lot of different angles. So when you look at the vision system, we can very easily test vision. And we know exactly where the nerves are that carry information about vision to the brain. And we can very easily study the areas of the brain that are associated with vision using neuroimaging. And so the idea is that we can sort of develop some techniques in sort of patients who have these vision problems and these tumors to identify sort of, like you said, biomarkers, areas where we can see that maybe this particular area of damage, the properties of the damage that are taking place may be predictive of how well they recover later on. And so if we can sort of apply these principles that we're using in our current patients to other models, that would be sort of the next step.
When it comes to vision problems that you describe with these kind of patients, we're talking about vision problems that were caused by the tumors?
That is correct.
Okay.
Yep. So, you know, these tumors press on a specific area of the nerve, and patients lose their vision in the periphery. So oftentimes, a patient will come into the clinic and they'll say, you know, I can't track that golf ball that I just hit. Or, you know, I have trouble sort of turning lanes while driving my car. So it's sort of out of the sides that they have difficulty seeing the most.
Let me ask you a question that may be within your field of research, and you might not have researched this, but this is a selfish question.
No, not a problem.
I'm a migraine sufferer, and I get visual aura with migraines. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I've been told by folks, I think at the Flaumeier Institute, I was told that there is some thought, and I don't know how firmly connected this is, that migraine with aura has a connection to stroke later in life. I'm not saying it's fully predictive, but does it... You know, when I go through an aura episode, which is usually about half an hour, it leads to brain pain. It leads to those issues. Is there a thought that there could be a connection? Have you heard
that? That question is outside of the scope of what we are researching in our lab. You know, I'm familiar and I've actually heard of some of the papers that discuss those things. But the mechanism by which a migraine with aura happens in the brain is a little bit different than the types of injuries that I study.
So you're telling me not to panic and just let's wait to see more research?
Yeah, I wouldn't panic just yet. I think, you know, it's best to wait for some more research to come out. I think that's sort of newer, up and coming. And, you know, I wouldn't speak more on that because it's a little outside the scope of what we do in our lab.
Okay. What's the easiest way to explain with the research that your lab is doing? The best case scenario, practical application. And sometimes these things take years to develop in terms of actual application. But what could be coming out of this?
Yeah. So I think the best case scenario right now is that we use a sort of technology called diffusion tensor imaging. It's a big word, but it's really just a fancy way of saying fancy MRI.
Okay.
And it would be really awesome if, you know, you had an individual with a specific type of brain injury that comes in to the, you know, hospital, and we can get, you know, this specific type of MRI. And we can look at sort of specific areas of their brain that are involved with the injury. And we can sort of provide them with information to let them know, hey, there's this very high chance that you're likely going to recover from this injury or not. Other things that we could use this for are sort of testing sort of novel therapies that are coming out. So there's sort of thought that stem cells might help to regenerate myelin in, you know, individuals with certain diseases. And we can use this sort of fancy MRI to measure the effectiveness of some novel therapeutics that are coming out.
Wow. David Paul, our guest in studio, along with Alika Bergelson, and we're talking about their fields of research, the University of Rochester, and we're talking kind of about the next generation of scientists. For a few more months, they're both under the age of 30. Until when, Alika?
August 29th.
Okay, so a few more months, and they've both earned some nice recognition for the work they're doing. And you can see what I think is so relatable about what Alika and David are doing is just how the practical application is clear to us, that unfortunately we all know someone who has suffered stroke or has had either brain injury or trauma or vision loss, et cetera, that we can relate to raising kids and wondering about language. But I also want to talk to them just about the field of science in general and the way, you know, whether what they're doing represents any change. Now, Alika grew up, again, in different places, but primarily where?
Columbus, Ohio.
Columbus, Ohio, and comes from a family that is from all over. Both parents Russian?
Both parents from Russia, and then they lived in Israel for a while, and they've been in Ohio for almost 30 years.
But you did not live in Israel.
I did not.
Okay, so you grew up in Ohio. Okay. And David, you grew up where?
I actually grew up in Michigan, the west coast of Michigan.
Michigan has a west coast?
Yes, it's very beautiful.
I guess it does have a west coast, doesn't it? I've never thought about Michigan in that way. And when did you end up in Rochester?
I came to Rochester for medical school about 5 years ago.
Okay. So at 26 years old, I'm fascinated by what they do, and David is going to get tired of this line of questioning immediately, and I'm sort of tired of asking this kind of question, but I'll ask you anyway. There's an idea that there aren't a whole lot of black scientists out there, and we need to see more of them. And what do you think? I mean, is it changing?
I think it's changing, but very slowly.
But very slowly?
Yeah. And I think there's definitely an area for improvement. And myself and a lot of my classmates and colleagues at the university are doing a lot to change that. Not just in science, but sort of in every field, engineering, all of the academic disciplines. We actually started a group on campus called the Minority Male Leadership Association. And with that sort of association, we pair up medical students and students along all the other sort of graduate schools, the School of Business. We have engineering students. We also have faculty. We pair them up and we mentor the undergrads. And then the undergrads, in turn, mentor high school students. They go out into the community. And every year we do what's called a success symposium. So we bring these students from, you know, Rochester City School District to the campus of Rochester. And we teach them all of these skills about, you know, how to get into college, you know, what to do with your summer, how to tie your tie, how to have elevator speech. We do all these amazing things with these students, and we have a keynote speaker come in, and we really sort of empower them. There's other things that are going on at the university. We could talk about them further if you'd like.
I'd love to hear this. And again, I hope it's clear, David, that in the tone of my question is, I don't want to have to ask this question anymore,
no.
but it's still a question. That we still need to see higher ranks of young black leaders in science.
Yeah.
So I do want to hear more.
Yeah.
So don't stop. Tell me.
So we also have an organization called the Student National Medical Association on campus. And that's an organization I'm part of as well. And there's another sort of yearly thing that we plan. It's called the pre-medical conference, the Student National Medical Association pre-medical conference. And we have about 200 students every year. High school students and college students who come to the campus for an entire day. And in that day, they sort of go through simulation experiences of medical school. They have sort of a pathology lab where one year we actually brought in like brains for the students to like hold and look at. This year it was like a bunch of bones. They also have like opportunities to like learn how to suture. And we bring in prominent speakers. We brought in speakers from like Johns Hopkins. We had a wonderful speaker here from the University of Rochester. And these students just, they leave like fired up and excited about, you know, pursuing a career in medicine. And one of the awesome things is that, you know, there's a student who I actually met through this conference that we host here at the university. He was a freshman at the time at the University of Rochester, and he just kept bugging me. He got my email. He emailed me constantly and constantly. And I finally, we sat down and talked, and he actually did an independent study with me in my lab. And then he worked over that summer. He got funding to do summer research. He's one of the authors on the paper that we just presented, and he's now accepted to Drexel University School of Medicine. And so I think that, you know, what we're doing is actually making an impact and a change. It's slow, you know, but it's needed work. It's something that, you know, we need to do to, you know, give back to the community. Because, you know, the thing is, when you go to the doctor, right, you know, you want to sometimes go to someone who you can relate to, and you want to go to a doctor that's invested in health disparities. If you're coming from, you know, an area that, you know, doesn't have great health care. And so, you know, if we can get more doctors of color that are interested in health care disparities and eliminating barriers, I think we're going to be able to provide better health care to patients in general.
Have you had any pushback from anybody in your life growing up who was surprised you were in science for any reason?
I will actually tell you this very interesting story.
Okay.
So in third grade, this is actually when I read the book by Dr. Ben Carson, and this is actually what prompted my parents to sort of have me read this, is that my teacher in third grade wanted to classify me as special education, which is absolutely crazy. And my parents said, no, it's not my son. You know, I know my child. I know that he's a bright young kid. And they had me read this book. And before I could go outside and play, do anything, they had me write a one-page essay on what I read.
In third grade?
In third grade.
Okay.
And they documented this. They documented all of my essays that I wrote, everything. And they brought it to sort of the school board. And the school board was like, why were you thinking that he was special education? And sort of my parents sort of, I think, push in my life got me over that hump. I think that, you know, some individuals who may not have, you know, parents who are pushing them or those sort of resources may get caught up in the system, you know. Students, unfortunately, are tracked. If you come from a certain area or you live in a certain place, at least, you know, where I came from, students often were not allowed to take advanced placement classes or honors classes. They got sort of tracked into a remedial route. And my parents said, no, not my children.
What an amazing story. But I can't believe that. I guess I still don't understand why a teacher would have made that assessment. I mean, that's hard to understand. What a story. But are these stories common?
You know, talking to sort of friends, I think everybody has said some level of, you know, adversity. I can't not speak for all African Americans. I can only, you know, share my story with you, and, you know, those other individuals would have to share their stories with you. And I think everybody has a different path, and everybody comes from different life circumstances. You know, and there's diversity in, you know, in social situations among African Americans, just like there are, you know, among other races. And so I think that's, you know, a question that's better asked, you know, on an individual basis. And I can only provide you with my story.
Amy writes to us, I teach high school science. We have today off. Please give David a hug for me. Yes, yes, yes. So
that's awesome.
I can't reach you to give you the hug across the table, but Amy says a hug for you. I think she's just thrilled to hear getting kids, providing leadership, providing mentorship, to getting more people involved in the field of medicine and science, as you say. So you're starting to see some results from the initiatives you've been doing here?
Yes, several students that I've seen come through those two programs are now enrolled in college. Some of them are now enrolled in medical school. A few of them at the University of Rochester, the one student I told you who's at Drexel. It's amazing to sort of see the pipeline that we're creating here in Rochester. And, you know, the 9% graduation rate is unacceptable, absolutely unacceptable. And that's the MMLA, the Minority Male Leadership Association, was founded to specifically address that and to change the narrative. You know, it's we want it to be a success narrative. So the idea is not to, you know, to speak about all of the negative things that are happening in our community. We want to highlight the positive things that African-American men are doing here in the city of Rochester.
No question about it. One of the great lessons I learned last year on the program, we had Pastor Marlo Washington in, and he said, you know, one of the biggest differences, he said, Evan, one of the biggest differences between you and me is people meet you and they assume that you're a smart guy unless you prove otherwise. He said, they meet me and I have to prove to them that I'm a smart guy and they may assume otherwise. We've got to get away from this tyranny of expectations, where we have this tyranny that says someone growing up like David, that young black students, that we're going to assume that they wouldn't get into science unless they really reach for it and prove it. We should present that opportunity and assume that they may want it just like anybody else. And I think what you're doing is wonderful stuff. So here's to a future where this isn't a need of a conversation, and we'll spend the entire hour on research. I think it's a good goal to have, but I also think that you're part of the reason that we might actually get there. So thanks for filling us in on that. We've got a few minutes left as we talk about the future of science. I should ask you a little bit about STEM. As we have a 29-year-old woman who's doing amazing things in this studio. I married a scientist, a woman much smarter than I am. And are you seeing, when you grew up, wasn't that long ago that you were in school and thinking about what you wanted to do. Are there appropriate approaches and resources for young girls especially? We've talked about the psychology of that and what starts to change in middle school and high school. What are your thoughts about that?
So I think that is also something that is definitely changing even in, you know, the preceding decade. I think that in my particular area, it's a little bit interestingly in the other direction, which is that developmental psychologists tend to be female-heavy rather than male-heavy as a field. Which may have to do with ideas about babies and development and who might know about that. But certainly within cognitive science more broadly, it is still male-dominated, and there are more and more aspects of the infrastructure to help with that. So, you know, as a graduate student, I could apply for money from the Women in Science organization that would provide travel funding to a conference and mandate that you have some mentorship set up at that conference for you. And so I think that there's more awareness about this. And I think that just like the things that David was talking about, we were talking about earlier, part of it has to do with much earlier in the education process, making girls and boys equally aware of the kinds of things they can and can't do in terms of what toys are available to them and all of that. So I think it's really a cultural systemic thing in the earlier in a kid's development that gets that they get boosted, the better.
And, you know, some of the pushback I've heard people say, well, boys and girls are different. Men and women are different. You can't wipe away all differences. No one wants to wipe away differences. We just want to have equality of opportunity. And I think that's what's been lacking in so many ways over the years. If you're just joining us, Elika Bergelson is someone who researches and focuses some of her work on the development of language, even starting at 6 months old. It's been a fascinating conversation about that. And, you know, parents do stress about this. Do you have friends, especially probably at your age, you've got some friends who have kids. Do you have friends who get worried about language development? It's easy to get worried. And I think I look at my two nephews a year apart, and one was so far advanced in terms of language. The other comes along 13 months later, and it took him years to catch up. And now they're roughly the same. I'm not saying it always works out that way, but do parents sort of come to you and they want a diagnosis?
Yeah, parents do worry. I like to stress that I am not the kind of doctor that can diagnose those kinds of things.
I was going to say poor Elika, because parents are probably coming to you and you're saying, well, look, that's right.
We
I'm not here to give you a diagnosis,
that's right?
That's right.
But I do find that tends to be a tendency more with first children. And then by the time you have a second or third child, you know, they can go play in the dirt out back and they're going to be just fine.
Or eat it. You know, it's interesting. The best book we got before my son was born was How to Have Your Second Child First. Parents, I totally endorse that book. The whole notion is don't worry about them playing in the dirt. And if they start eating the dirt, make sure they're only eating a moderate amount, but don't worry about it, to Elika's point. No, it's great. But I think people, if they're asking you, it's because they care. And this is such an important field for parents who really want what's best for their kids. We're not talking about helicopter parents. We're not talking about overdoing it. We're talking about understanding the way people develop. And Elika's work is going to help parents understand. And then I think it'll help us understand, as next hour we're going to talk about how to make education better, especially in impoverished areas. And what are the factors? And how do we start to address that? And if we know that language is part of that, and we do, but if we can start to understand to the extent, don't you see a future in which we're helping address even language development? And then think of the cascade for a child who can speak more efficiently and at a level that is more appropriate. It's got to have impact far beyond just being able to talk.
Absolutely. And that's definitely something we know from the research. So your early language skills end up predicting all sorts of things like high school graduation rates and, you know, success in life with by various measures.
Being taken more seriously, being respected. I mean, all of the things. I think it's going to be fascinating to see. So will you come back sometime and share how it's going?
Sure, anytime.
At the Baby Lab. I always love hearing about there's a Baby Lab in Rochester, the Rochester Baby Lab. There's such cool stuff happening there. Elika Bergelson, great stuff. Congratulations on the Forbes honor of 30 Under 30 in Science. Well-deserved. And I do look forward to future conversations with you on this.
Thanks, Evan.
And David Paul, thanks for being here for the first time. And I suspect, again, as long as you hang around Rochester, we're going to be thrilled to hear about the work that you and the other scientists at the lab are doing there. It's going to be great for you to keep us up to date on not only recovery from brain injury, but so much else. So thank you for taking the time to be here.
Thanks again for having me.
Great panel on our monthly science roundtable. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to stay on education, but focus a little bit differently as we go into the next hour. Fairport Superintendent Bill Calla is here, and we're talking about his rather harsh critique of Governor Cuomo and the state's education agenda. He'll answer our questions and yours next hour on Connections.